another episode of Two Crickets in a Thorn Tree. I'm your host, or half of your hosts, Nicholas Lorimer, joined, of course, by the other half of your hosts,
Gabriel Krauser.
Indeed. And today, we're going to be talking about a few of our favorite things. I think recently we keep veering off into these sort of apocalyptic discussions about how the world's going to fall apart or end, or how things are never going to go away, or how we're all doomed. So I'm sure there'll be a little bit of that today, but we're going to talk about some things that we find absolutely delightful and entertaining, and we've compiled a rough list for your entertainment and enjoyment.
Yeah, so just to give some context to this, my writing mentor Rian Malan, he made a documentary around the time that Jacob Zuma became president, just over a decade ago. And he sort of went around the country and did interviews and spoke to the man on the street, as it were, spoke to Jacob Zuma himself, spoke to various politicians. And he was sort of trying to answer the question, does Zuma becoming president mean the doom of South Africa? And there were a lot of flags pointing to yes, and it was pretty worrying. It was pretty clear at the time that Zuma was guilty of corruption, that he had this sort of ethnic nationalist thing going for him,
right,
that the rule of law was not really something to
at
live
the front
by.
Of his mind, no,
no. But at the same time, Rian looked quite hard for signs of hope, and he found an interesting one, which was the stand-up comedians at the time that were doing really well were lampooning the old shibboleths upon which
Zuma had constructed the edifice of his evil.
Yeah, exactly. And so you'd have these crosscuts of like Zuma saying, you know, the only people who are against me, they're agents of the CIA or the white monopoly capital or whatever the phrase was of the time. And then cutting to stand-up comedians, young stand-up comedians in Joburg and Cape Town or wherever, sort of making fun of Zuma playing the race card. And I suppose it was part of the story that these young stand-ups were mostly black or not white and had grown up pretty poor and had just heard the same old story long enough, and their audiences had heard the same old story long enough, that they could play to crowds anywhere in the country, townships or urban centers, wherever, and make fun of this, and people were laughing. And it was a real sign of hope. And of course, one of the great ironies is that the single stand-up comedian that got the most playtime on Rian's documentary was Trevor Noah, who has
subsequently, perhaps shall we, gone off of that track. He's found a new path in life.
Yes, yes. So you know, I suppose that's a warning sign, that the things that we're going to turn to, the funny things that we turn to, they might be signs of where basic humanity is just incapable of upholding the narrative and so starts laughing at it, and that can be really healthy. Or maybe it's early signs of madness.
Or maybe both.
Maybe a bit of both. But that's the idea, is that there's something very important about comedy. And the other reason that I wanted to do this, although we had this idea a month ago, really, right at the start of the year, when we were first talking about, you know, what can we do that's unlike what we've done before for our listeners. We had this idea, but it really became urgent to me after a vlog that Nicholas hosted a couple of days ago on Wednesday with France Crenier, our CEO, and Terence Corrigan and me.
Yeah.
And basically it was one of the hardest sort of public appearances I've ever had to make, because we had to talk about the fact that the Institute of Race Relations has been fighting against expropriation without compensation since around 14 years, and that we are about to lose a major battle. The expropriation bill is almost certain to be passed soon. The date for making submissions is the 28th of February. After that, you won't be able to sort of officially speak to Parliament about it anymore. If you haven't made a submission, let me urge you to do that. I just sent the link out to a few of my friends and they just all signed up now. I think we've got 25,000 now or something in this latest batch. And
yeah, and in total, we're over 200,000, I think, just from us. And then there are other civil society organizations that are putting together stuff. The DA has got some things. I think AfriForum probably has something as well. But I think ours is one of the bigger ones. There may be some others that are slightly ahead of us.
I think DA South Africa is the biggest. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Possibly. If you wanna sign up to that as quickly as possible, go to rr.org.za, and then there should be a big button that says Stop EWC on the front page there. So just click that.
So and the thing is. The thing to be aware of is that it's not over, and it's important to get these submissions through because the next phase is going to be to stop implementation.
Right.
Now, it's important to remember that for the last year or so, the proponents of the expropriation bill have been saying, no, look, we're not going to implement it. So so it might sound like we're fighting – like we're boxing ghosts that don't really exist. But remember before that when Ramaphosa first became president in February 2018, he was saying, look, we need to do this because, you know, we can create more investment by expropriating people's investments, and we can create more economic growth by redistributing wealth in this extraordinary way. So and a lot of Ramaphoriacs were very on board with that message. So that message didn't change from, look, we're going to change the law so that we can do a lot, to we're going to change the law so that we won't really do anything at all without pushback. And right. And once you change the law, the guys that are going to be making the decisions are going to be low-level municipal guys, and they need the most pushback possible. So the next step is going to be more legalistic, but maintaining the public pressure and actually increasing the public pressure is going to be very important, right, so that political processes eventually can catch up with this and the law can be changed again. And in the meantime, we need it not to be implemented. So one battle's lost. The war's not over at all. There's still so much to lose.
Indeed.
There's so much to...
And you can actually see some of this retreat in that. I've started to see defenders of the bill very much sticking to that nonsense Ramaphosa line, which is, oh, you know, we need to do this, but we need to do it in a way that doesn't hurt the economy. And that's obviously a weak position to be in, because there is no way you can do this without hurting the economy. So
yeah,
the rhetorical battle is turning in some ways, even as the legislative sort of, I don't know what to call it, steamroller, slow creeping avalanche glacier thingy crawls forward.
That's a lot of metaphors. Very good, Nick.
We need to make a very big fire in the way of this creeping glacier
of the avalanche. Yeah, we need a mob. Yes. Very good, very good, very good. So we're doing that.
We're not all poets.
And right at the end of it, Nicholas asked me, like, is there anything from Russian poetry? Because I've been talking about a bit of Russian history, to draw on, and I thought of Joseph Brodsky, who was the last Soviet to win a Nobel Prize for poetry, and he went to the Gulag and he was heavily oppressed, and, you know, he had a tough life than you or me. But at the same time, and, you know, a lot of his good friends were killed by the government and all that. But he kept his sense of humor. And part of the reason that the Russians survived, and part of the way that they sort of got rid of the Soviet Union, was by jokes.
Yeah.
So this really does matter.
So hold on.
And we want to share some jokes.
Yeah, we didn't talk about this before the show, but go onto YouTube and look up Ronald Reagan's Soviet Union jokes. So Reagan, in doing some press conferences and stuff, he recognized this power of humor, and so he liked to tell some jokes at the expense of the Soviet system that he claimed, and I believe that he is correct in saying, were from Soviet citizens or
absolutely
themselves.
Yeah.
And they are even now, they are still genuinely funny to listen to all these years later.
My favorite one, although it's very hard, it's the hardest one to deliver in a funny way. My favorite one is the guy who goes to pay for a new car, a Lada. and they say, oh, very good, thank you for your money, you have to pay now, you can come collect the car later. And he says, oh, okay, I was hoping for the car now, but anyway, when will the car be ready? And they said, in 8 years, on the first Monday of February. And he says, oh, and what time can I come collect the car? And they say, well, 11:30 in the morning should be good. But, you know, it's a long time from now. Why do you ask? He said, oh, because I've got a dentist appointment on that morning at 9 o'clock.
No, my favorite of them is the American and a Soviet citizen are arguing about, you know, what you can say, what makes their country great. And the American says, you know, in America, you can go right up to the president's desk, you can pound the table, and you can say, Mr. President, I don't like what you're doing. And the Soviet says, that's not special. You can do that in the Soviet Union. I can go right into the Kremlin. I can go to the office of the General Secretary. I can pound on the table and I can say, Mr. General Secretary, I do not like the job President Reagan is doing.
It's so true. And it's so worrying. I think my deeper takeaway on Sona that we talked a little bit about on Monday is that Ramaphosa is really starting to turn the screw on the critics. Don't be a doomsayer. Like he's straw manning badly. He said, yeah, you know, everyone said there's going to be this chaos. There's going to be chaos when the vaccine comes. No one said there's going to be chaos. We said precisely the problem is there's not going to be enough movement.
Right.
So he's not addressing the real
problem. We just said it won't happen. Like, time years matter. We didn't say that it would be chaos. Besides, there's still lots of opportunity for chaos to creep in. It's not day one that the chaos comes in. It's day six, day 10.
Just this line. Either we stand together, you know, for the most part, he said, for the most part, we stood together. There were some people who were critics, and the criticism will always go on. But what matters the most is that we stand united against the virus, which sounded very much like what matters the most is don't criticize us right now because we've got a virus to deal with.
Because it's hard, guys. You don't understand. It's so hard.
Yeah, and it is hard, but it's also hard on our side, you know, that. My favorite old African idiom was when two elephants clash, it's the grass that takes the brunt of it, you know. And yes, I feel so a little bit sorry for the giant elephant Ramaphosa and the giant elephant Zuma and Magashule, and these clashes are, I'm sure it's very difficult to deal with all of that. But from the grass's point of view, let me tell you, it ain't easy.
No, it ain't nice. It ain't so nice. Right, so which of the things are we going to do first? We want to do the documentaries first?
Yeah, let's start with the documentaries. We're going to build to our very favorite. Nicholas and I independently have one favorite South African thing.
Yes, no, that's definitely true.
But we're going to start abroad. And I think, Nicholas, why don't you kick us off with your favorite documentary about Italian, shall we say, exceptionalism?
So... I just want to give a bit of background about the YouTube channel which does this. It's called Internet Historian. It's quite a big YouTube channel. I think it's got several million subscribers. I think it's an Australian or New Zealander. And he just makes videos about stuff that was mostly on the internet, kind of sort of journalistically in nature, but he doesn't do any, you know, sort of frontline reporting himself. But he does look through court records. He does look through news stories, and he kind of pieces together things that happened in the relatively, you know, quite recently that usually were quite popular online. So he's done a couple of videos, one of them that's the most interesting and actually turns from being something quite silly into something quite dark is his discussion of an internet viral meme called Balloon Boy, which is about the a kid who allegedly got stuck in a balloon and then it was accused of being a hoax in 2009. Anyway, so that's kind of interesting. But his most recent video, I think, is his best. And it's called The Cost of Concordia. Yeah, it came out this week. It's about a shipwreck in 2012 of a big cruise liner called the Costa Concordia, which cost $512 million to build.
And that's 2005 dollars. So
right.
It's
so,
closer to a billion in today's terms.
Yeah, it's a big deal. And this ship was wrecked. Basically by the incompetence of its captain and his bridge crew. And he goes through in a blow-by-blow account using the records from the ship's black box, basically, to talk about how exactly this happened and how completely avoidable, incompetent, and ridiculous the whole affair was. Everything from the fact that the captain was showing off to his mistress at the time, who was on the bridge.
Yeah,
with him. The fact that the third officer was lazy and didn't do her job properly. The fact that they had decided to hire a very, very cheap helmsman to actually do the physical steering of the ship. A Indonesian guy who had previously been a painter.
Who also didn't speak Italian or English very well.
Yes, so he kept messing up the commands.
Just imagine the scene. So this is the scene, right? You're on this like billion-dollar cruise ship. You've got thousands upon tens of thousands of passengers all there spending lots of money listening to the fancy.
There are five restaurants, a casino, a three-level theater on this thing. It's a huge ship,
and they're in the thing, and they're busy watching a magic act, and some woman is about to be sawed in half, but not really. And in the bridge, the captain decides. And the captain, by the way, is elevated mysteriously very, very quickly from being security dude. Yeah,
he's a security officer who manages to become captain in about 2 or 3 years.
And he's got such a stereotypical Italian look. Like, he's quite handsome, but he's a little bit overweight, but his skin is super smooth and sallow. And
he's got that bronze Mediterranean glow, you know?
he just like oozes lots of things, including confidence, but also other things.
Yes.
And he's on the bridge, and his mistress is there, who got onto the ship without a ticket, and then they pretended that she was like a hostess, but then she wasn't on the records of being like someone who works there. So he just gives her like hostess uniforms, and she walks around, and she comes on the bridge, and he's like, "Oh, my darling, we're going to do a beautiful drive-by." So there's this little island called like
Gelino. Girona or something like that, and it's just off the coast of Sicily, I think. No, off the coast of Western Italy. I can't remember that region. Anyway, yeah, it's up there.
So the idea is that they're gonna sail quite close to this island, and then people can wave at the island, and the people of the island can wave at them. But he says, "Oh, darling, usually it's 2 miles, but we are going to go less than 1 mile, so you can see the flowers, the beautiful flowers in the middle of the night, the spring, summer night. Oh, wonderful." And dude, and one of my favorite parts is they're so casual about this that he's like steering towards the island, thinking he's going past it, but he's actually by mistake because the coordinates aren't right, steering into the island.
But mostly because the helmsman didn't understand the instructions properly, and for a second there, gives the wrong heading on the ship.
So he phones the previous captain of the ship, who happens to live on the island, at like 11 at night or whatever it is. And he's like, "Oh, Carlo, how close do you think you can go to this island?" And he's like, "Oh, Antonio, we don't go closer than 2.5 miles. And he says, "Oh, Carlo, you are so weak. We are going to go less than 1 mile. And he says, "Oh, well, I'm a bit sleepy right now, but that doesn't sound like a great idea." This is all paraphrasing. If you want the real exact word.
Yeah, watch the video.
But then they're like, okay, the clouds lift and they see the island is right ahead. So he's like, "Oh, Giuseppe, we have to turn right." And then Giuseppe's like, "Oh, did you say we turn left?" And he says, "No, turn right." He's like, "Okay, we're going to turn left." And then the other guy's like, "No, we have to turn right." And there's all these miscommunications. And it is
But here's the real drama of the thing, actually, right? So this the ship crashes.
Well, then they hit a rock. Yeah. They hit a huge rock and it tears open the whole side. While they're driving at the rock, the guy literally says, "Turn starboard," and then the other guy interprets that as "turn aft," or whatever the opposite is.
Turn port. So all this incompetence leads to the crash, but the worst part is the captain then proceeds to deny that the ship is sinking, basically until things have gone completely wrong, and they lie to the passengers a couple of times, I think for about 20 minutes. They just keep lying.
All the power goes out.
The ship is starting to tilt on its side. And the passengers end up basically ignoring the crew staff and getting the lifeboats ready themselves and putting on the life jackets themselves.
Dude, then one passenger uses her smartphone, this like nice old lady. She's like,
this isn't the right
line. Marcello, this is not making sense to me. They are saying there is merely a power outage, but I've been on many cruises before, and in a power outage, the ship is not turning 30 degrees on its axis. Look, the lady who was in the box, she's fallen off the stage. It is tilted. This is not the power outage. So he says, okay, call the harbor. So she calls the harbor.
She calls her daughter, who calls the police, who calls the harbor.
And then the harbor calls the guy back, and they're like, we've already spoken about this. And you're saying there's a power outage, but people on board are saying that the ship is tilting. And he says, no.
Nothing's wrong. No reason to worry. We're not going to order any evacuations. Everything starts to go wrong. And towards the end of, as the whole disaster is unfolding, it becomes clear they need to abandon ship. Even the captain realizes at the end. But before he gives the order to evacuate, and this is not a joke, he changes into a suit. It looked good when he gets to shore.
Fabio cannot simply arrive in a captain's uniform. He has to put on Armani suit. What?
As he's abandoning ship in a lifeboat, another veteran captain calls him and says, "Where are you? Someone told me that you'd left the bridge, that you were getting off the ship." And then the captain replies, "Well, I slipped and fell into a lifeboat, and I guess it's just easy if I go to shore now, because that's just how it's going." And then he says, in Italian, "Get the F back on board."
Which then becomes a huge slogan across Italy.
Yeah, it becomes a slogan in Italy, because I think a recording of this radio transmission gets picked up by local radio, and they play it. And anyway, he then pretends to not understand what the guy's telling him to do and puts the phone down. The captain spent the rest of the rescue sitting on a rock watching the ship without helping anyone before going back to his hotel room and then giving a false interview to reporters where he claimed he was the last person to leave the ship.
He is really a bad dude.
And it gets worse, because it wasn't just the ship got wrecked. 30 people got killed, 32 people. It was absolutely horrific, plus a rescue worker who also died during the sort of salvage operations. So, it's amazing. Yeah.
So it's as bad as can be. And then somehow, I mean, it can't get worse than people dying, but somehow the story doesn't end. The spectacular failure continues, where then the ship is full of cash at the casinos and like expensive liquor, and these Italian divers just descend upon the ship and start looting it blind.
They strip it of basically everything, including its ship's bell.
And then they find, like, then there's this question about this one helicopter, which was the first thing to leave before the emergency was called, which might have landed on the helicopter deck and left with lots of cocaine. And then there's questions about whether the captain was actually on coke at the time. And they found, like, some traces of cocaine on his hair. And the guy who said F off, the captain who was on shore, who was trying, the old veteran who was trying to sort of keep everything going, he becomes a politician because he, for criticizing this dude and the whole debacle, he gets demoted and transferred elsewhere. And, you know, and there's this popular uprising, like, how the hell he's the one guy who is kind of trying to do the right thing and he's demoted. So then he's like, fine, I'm just going to quit the Admiralty and become a politician. And yeah, between the drugs and the mistress and there's also people who are like far away on the other end of Italy who are claiming they're on the ship and that they deserve payout.
And they need compensation. And basically at the end of the day, everyone manages to largely escape, get off scot-free. Not quite scot-free, but close to.
The captain goes to jail.
The captain goes to jail, sort of, but like the company manages to get off. The helmsman, the Indonesian who didn't speak English or Italian well, just disappears. He goes back to Indonesia. They track him down in Indonesia and he disappears again, and no one's found him since.
Look, the company did pay out many millions of euros. The average person got like 16,000 euros. The minimum was 16,000 euros for the people who just were inconvenienced.
Yeah.
And the families of those who died got millions of euros, undisclosed amounts and whatever. So it's not like
in civil cases that came afterwards. But in terms of criminal negligence stuff, they A lot of basically everyone except the captain seems to have gotten off.
Yeah. No, I think the third helmsman and the first helmsman got like a year.
Yeah, they did community service.
Yeah. So it's just, I don't know. It's a tragedy. It's a comedy, and it's well worth the 45 minutes it takes to watch, because you'll get more details than we're able to portray. But yes. One of the things that's interesting about it is that it feels like such a South African story in a way.
Right.
You know, we think we're the only guys who have this terrible incompetence, but the style and
all the shortcuts and the just completely avoidable nonsense and the ego that's going on here is you can see it happening in South Africa, and then you can also see the sort of debacle of an aftermath being like South Africa. I mean, if there was a ship with all that valuable stuff that crashed off of our shore, you can be sure that we would loot it even faster than the Italians. So,
but it's got incompetence is global. The flavors are particular, but the secret sauce of as you say, ego and shortcuts and whatever, that is a universal thing. And I think it's great to see. This video will definitely make you laugh, and it'll definitely hurt your heart. And so that's our strong first recommendation. Our second recommendation is a documentary which isn't as obviously funny. It's not trying to be as funny, although there are some stinging one-liners, made by Alexei Navalny, who was perhaps, you know, there's the story about he was poisoned. Perhaps
you may know him as the dude who got poisoned.
Yeah. Sort of opposition, symbolic opposition leader in Russia to Vladimir Putin. And he made a documentary 2 years ago or 3 years ago about Medvedev, who's Putin's number two, about all Medvedevs and Kandlas. And the great thing is that he sort of this is hour and a half thing where he's got these org charts that sort of show how the network works and the shell companies and all of that. But he also gets these drones, these very expensive sort of high quality drones with great cameras that fly over the various estates so that you can see how deluxe they are. Anyway, he's now decided to do that with Putin. And Putin's palace, that's what it's called. It is, I don't know how accurate it is. I've tried doing some follow-up research. It looks pretty plausible. The story has been around for the last 10 years. There hasn't been a lot of plausible deniability. But it's I suppose, just to give you a sense of it, on the Black Sea, in the southern part of Russia, there is an area about 500 hectares. There's sort of like beautiful white cliffs, sheer roaring out of the ocean, and then curving onto this green hill. And atop that is a gargantuan palace, unlike anything in South Africa at all. And there is an underwater hockey rink. I'm sorry, an underland, there's an ice hockey rink that is built in a bunker.
Okay.
So just to give you a sense of the scale, that's like one of the small side things. There's a tea room, it's called the tea room, which is really like a five-story side palace for where the guests go to stay, with several terraced balconies, with a bridge, with a suspension bridge that's like as long as Storms River Bridge, going from the main sort of hill to that
Gabriel,
hill.
Gabriel, you can't have a czar without a palace.
He's got the main entrance hall is very tsarist. It's literally got the tsarist symbol. The gate is an exact reproduction of the Tsar's Winter Palace main entrance gate. There's a hookah lounge, which has conveniently got a pole, which you press a button and then the stage lifts and then a pole comes out of it. And Navalny says, "We wonder what for reason there can be a pole in the hookah lounge. Maybe it is for putting up a Christmas tree."
That's a very Russian joke.
There's also halfway down, so there's an elevator. This thing is about one, the hill is very high. It's like a kilometer up. There's an elevator that goes through the mountain down to sea level and then goes across to the coast so that you can sort of step out and then have a little swim. But halfway through, I suppose that's not normal, but that is understandable. But halfway through the elevator, there's a secret stop point, and there's a secret tunnel that then goes out to halfway up the mountain with like an invisible window from the outside so that you can have sundowners looking over the ocean, but no one from the outside can see you. It's a no-fly zone over it. You have this phone call to the Russian naval authority where they say, hey, I've got a shipping boat, a fishing boat. I want to go past this area. You always have to ask for permission, sort of just chart out your course. Same with airplane flights. Most places in the world is like that. And then they say, oh, you want to go there? Sorry, could you just go a mile out to sea when you're going around this area for mysterious undisclosed reasons? So it really looks bad. Officially, the company that owns it purchased the land and has been building this project for the last 15 years. The budget is like in the billions of dollars. It's a children education research facility.
Perfect. Can I say something? You called it an Nkandla. Can I say something about Nkandla? So I think that it's interesting that Nkandla got to be such a big story, right? Because the government has done worse things.
Yeah.
You know, you can think of a couple off the top of your head. Is the Itsumedi stuff, although obviously that came after. There was the stuff around HIV and AIDS. There was so many things the government has done worse. And in other cases where the corruption has been more damaging.
Yeah.
But you know what really infuriates me about Nkandla?
Yeah.
The fact that Zuma got screwed. Have you seen how much of a trash heap that place is? It is not worth the money they spent on it. There was some inflation going there. Whoever built that for Zuma, yes, it was taxpayers' money, and yes, Zuma should never have gotten that money, blah, 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 all of that. But really, the amount of money they spent on it and how little they got for it is what really annoys me.
So, you know, if you're going to have a kleptocratic president, this is
can you at least have a palace?
Like because okay, so this thing came out, and this Navalny documentary came out within a week. And it's, I mean, the documents that they use look very legit, and they've got people who were part of the construction team, and they've got people who were part of Putin's inner circle who kind of have gone whistleblower. Yeah. And they get into various other side palaces. Putin's got several alleged mistresses, and they all get a yacht and a very fancy apartment and all kinds of things, whatever. It's like it's a very Nkandla-esque story in that sense. But here's what's telling. Levada, which is the sort of grand independent pollster of Russia, did a survey a week after the thing had been released. And they found, you know, it had been viewed like 130 million times around the world. They found 1 in 4 Russians said that they'd seen it, which would line up with that. Like, you know, 30 million Russians.
That's also a lot of people to watch a YouTube video, basically.
Yeah. And 3 in 4 Russians had heard about it. So Russians over the age of 55, 50% of them that had seen it thought it was fake news, and 50% thought it was the real deal. And of Russians 18 to 34, the supermajority, like 75% thought it was real, and like 20% or whatever thought it was fake news.
Right.
So that's not totally surprising. I mean, I think it's a high number, like half of the sort of senior generation that watched it thought this is real. So a lot of people obviously take it very seriously. For all that, only like 30% of the people who watched it said that their idea about Putin had reduced after watching the thing. And like 5% said that their opinion of Putin had actually improved.
Well, exactly. People like a bit of pantomime.
And why? At a deeper level, why? And the pollsters show this. Because most people that approve say, look, whatever, our lives are improving.
Right.
So if you look at Russia, the big news, the big financial news coming out of Russia in the first quarter of 2021 is that their government balance sheet has gone positive. That's to say the government owns more than it owes. There are very few governments.
Must be nice.
Must be nice. Their debt to GDP ratio is something like 15%. They've been running budget surpluses.
Mm.
Their GDP growth has been in keeping with emerging market patterns, you know, ranging between 4% and 7%. They were growing under Putin. Putin became president in 2000. After that, we were bragging about growing at 5%. They're growing at more than that. And their growth was more consistent. And they finally got knocked in the teeth when they annexed the Crimea. The oil price suddenly shot down. Many people inside the Russian sphere believe that it's because the Saudis and the Americans had gotten together to drive the oil price down. Others say that's a silly conspiracy theory and there were fundamentals. There was a sort of production glut, a supply glut, an increased move towards green energy and so on. Whatever the case may be, the oil price went from sort of a high of around $120 per barrel to a low of around $20 per barrel. Then it started climbing up back up a little bit, but the Russians weren't making as much money out of it. And they had sanctions, major sanctions placed against the country. So there was a little bit of economic contraction, but it didn't last. There was a sudden and serious recovery from that too. COVID, I've just been reading the Moscow Times, Russia has had the worst excess death per population in Europe by quite a stretch. So in that sense, it's bizarre that people haven't been complaining more. There's a question about whether it's because they just don't get the information or because Russians have a more raw attitude towards large numbers of people dying at once. Right.
They have some historical experience with these things.
Yeah. But so I'm not trying to paint like an overly rosy picture of Russia, but I have visited Moscow for the last decade, and I have seen several suburbs go from like Hillbrow and Yeovil, seriously worse in some instances, mm-hmm. to being like Melrose Arch or Sandton. Mm-hmm. And that is just that just makes a difference to everyone who's living there. You know, places have gone from being criminal to safe. Houses have gone from being generally dilapidated to being upgraded, living standards improved, new jobs, unemployment much lower. And partly that's because, I mean, when the Russian minimum wage was introduced, it was something like 100, it was like literally 250 rand a month. And so it's increased by like a factor of 8. So now it's like 2000 rand a month versus our 3.6 or whatever it is. But they've just made much more pragmatic steps. They haven't tried to solve every problem at once. And so where they have tried to solve a problem, they often actually have solved it. And people feel that their living circumstances have improved and also, and as such, are very sympathetic towards their, call him a president, call him an emperor, call him a reformer, call him whatever you want to call him. They're Vladimir Putin. Vladimir Vladimirovich. Oy. My tongue Russian's is getting stuck rusty. In my throat.
You need to go and spend some more time in Moscow.
They're very sympathetic to that. I think it's a fascinating documentary to watch, with that lingering at the back of your mind, and also with it lingering at the back of your mind that this is what, when I was studying journalism, I took one class in journalism when I was in America, and I had friends who then immediately went on from there to study at NYU, which has the state's most prestigious program, to work at the New York Times and work at the New Yorker. And what we were promised was this kind of activist journalism, people with a lot of money throwing a lot of resources at both the hard sort of financial research side, because digging into these shell companies really takes a lot of smart man hours, and the manpower side, you've got dudes getting on ships, going as close to the thing as they can go, watching out for the government to swoop in on them, sending drones up into the air, flying in the CGI recreation of the interior of the house so that you can do a virtual tour through it, the sort of one-on-one interviews with people that then need serious protection because of all the potential backlash. It's like a huge – the budget for this thing is like a small Hollywood movie. It couldn't really easily be done. It couldn't be done by any Russian publication. It could be done by an independently wealthy lobbyist,
yeah,
politician. And the upshot of it is a sight to behold. And the background funny thing is, you know, maybe this is why they were trying to assassinate him, if they were trying to assassinate him. So it's also, on the one hand, the stakes are so high that this is the kind of journalism that you might get killed over. On the other hand, it's like the stakes are so low that you can show this. And It definitely changes some people's minds, but a lot of people are like, oh, that's great. Putin's got like a stripper pole with a hookah machine.
Yeah.
And several vineyards. And like, there I mean, some of it's quite classy.
There are certainly people in the country who felt the same way about Nkandla. Although, like I said, I personally thought that he got screwed.
Anyway, that's our second favorite thing recommendation.
Yes, yes. Two great documentaries. What was the name of yours again? What was the name, the actual title of the documentary?
In English, I think it's called Putin's Palace. Putin's Palace.
The YouTube channel I was talking about was, of course, Internet Historian, which also did a couple of other videos that are about sort of funny goings-on in internet subcultures, which you may find either a bit impenetrable because some people really don't care, and others may be slightly horrified by them to discover that these subcultures exist. But generally speaking, some really good content in there. What is our next items that we're going to talk about?
Okay, so we've got a few more, but I think we're going to have to skip through. I wanted to talk about Boris Johnson's debate with Mary Beard. Boris Johnson is obviously now the Prime Minister of the UK. Mary Beard is the sort of cultural attaché for the BBC, and the debate was were the Greeks better or were the Romans better? And it's kind of such a silly topic, and at the same time, it really brings out a lot of jokes about beheadings and fish sauce and tyranny and incest and all the kinds of things that happen in the ancient world that we now have the distance to laugh about and sort of, you know, minor genocides and all that kind of fun stuff. So,
when you put it like it really, that, Gabriel.
It really is one of the most bizarrely, chillingly humorous intellectual clashes, and the fireworks are amazing. I mean, Boris Johnson, love him or loathe him, he really knows how to do verbal theatrics, and so does Mary Beard. And they go at each other with teeth bared.
Really is a master of his shtick. His shtick of pretending to be this sort of slightly bumbling, incompetent, mumbling fool, and yet is actually a sort of cunning, devious fox. It's a part he plays extraordinarily well.
It's also very British, you know.
Yes,
I'm so intellectual that I can't remember how to say things in English.
Yes, exactly. And I've forgotten how to tie my shoes or do my hair.
Yes, my button's in the wrong hole and all that.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
My old withered cardigan, moth-eaten cardigan. Okay, the other small thing I wanted to say just about Nkandla is the comparison, the sort of mistress comparison. Like, there is something very special about Zuma's many wives and many mistresses, that that the grandest fiasco was that one of Zuma's wives was accused of having tried to poison him.
Poison him, yeah.
And I the video, my favorite video that hasn't been made, I pitched this to someone in Nando's, was that they should have that wife of Jacob Zuma say, you know, the root of a man's heart is through his stomach, and I was the best chef in Nkandla. I was cooking the best to Zuma's heart. And then those other ones got jealous, so they were accusing me of poison, but it wasn't poison, it was love. And now that I've been kicked out of Nkandla, I'm making chicken for Nando's. So if you want real love, if you want to know the president's best, come to me. I thought that would be a great ad if they could secure it.
Yeah, no, that would be nice, and that would be a good edgy ad. And I fear that the great tragedy of our time will be that the intrigue and internal politics of the Zuma household, there'll never be a great detailed account of that. And it probably is a story that could match the most magnificent courts of medieval Europe in terms of plotting, poisoning, backstabbing, tricking, you know, sex, violence, all the good stuff would be in there. And unfortunately, we're never going to find out the true story, perhaps, of that. Well, maybe we will. Maybe we'll get lucky yet. Maybe one of his kids will write something. Anyway, so let's talk
without further ado
about the star of the show.
Favorite South African thing.
the greatest performer in South Africa's recent history, as far as I'm concerned. He's very difficult to explain in words what the sort of appeal is. And I think we came across him both originally through viral videos. I didn't know at first what his name was for quite a long time. I searched for a while and eventually I found him on YouTube. He popped up. He got big overseas, and actually his videos went quite viral there for a while. His channel's still going, even though it's not nearly as viral anymore. And every single one of his videos is basically the same thing, and all of them are fantastic. So, Gabriel, would you be able to play us a bit of the video?
I'm just going to play you his latest. This is from 8 hours ago, and his name is Demi Demi.
Demi Demi.
But Demi Demi, listen to this. But Demi Demi, listen to this attentively. The best way to learn is to listen to the winners and repeat. The best way to learn is to listen to the winners and also go back and listen to the failures and the losers so that you can learn how did they fail so that you can prevent and learn from that. Some PSD, some Demi Demi, some MTN, some love, some thank you, thank you. Listen to this attentively. The best way to learn is to listen to the winners and also and listen to the losers so that you can learn from them how did they fail so that you can prevent it in future. Some power, some PSD, some...
Every time I think I'm going to get... I said this to you just before the show, but every time I think I'm going to get bored of that shtick, of the... Because every video is basically that. He gives an inspirational quote or some sort of thoughtful piece of, you know, like self-help advice, and then he ends it by going... he does it.
And if you watch the video, like, he goes in and out of the thing, and he's got these two golden teeth at the top and at the bottom, and he's full of his smile and full of... Yeah.
Every time I think I'm going to get bored of it, I watch another video and it cannot but bring a smile to my face. It's just so charming in a weird way. And he's so sort of, it's kind of weird because a lot of people in his comment section will point out that they can't tell whether he's sort of being slightly cynical and jokey about the advice he's giving or whether he's being really, really genuine. I think he is being genuine. And that's what's so delightful about it is he's just, you know, entertaining people and giving them good advice. And all of his videos are like pretty useful stuff. It's all about adding value, about being the best you could be, about, you know, making yourself fortunate and wealthy, about not being jealous, you know, just sort of simple stuff like that. And I really, it warms my heart. It really does. He's also got this sort of unique South African take on the whole thing. There've been some good edits of his videos. So
hold on. Yeah. Let me play.
Here's his greatest, his viral one.
Tough time never lasts. Only tough people last. Life is a very difficult exam. Many people are failing because they want to hope from others, not to realize that everyone has a different mission. Only the tallest tree has an experience of the roughest wind. All birds find a shelter when it's raining. But the eagle fly higher above the clouds.
All birds find shelter in the storm, but the eagle fly higher than the clouds. Dude, it's so good. And it's like, okay, so I didn't play the longer one, which is 2.5 minutes, where he starts out with this one, which you have to laugh at, because he says, everybody makes mistake, but somebody learns to turn their mistake into successes. And he sort of repeats this line and he keeps making grammatical mistakes and he keeps changing the grammatical mistakes that he makes. And it's kind of so obvious that it has this self-reflective irony of of him knowing he is such a working class chap. He sort of knows that he's not perfect. He knows that he's got a way to go and a way to grow, and that the thing that stands him in the best stead of getting where he wants to be is not some grand endowment of eloquence or of a fancy education. It is true grit.
Yes.
And that willingness to keep making the mistakes, but to shift them around and to kind of push through the little ones to find the big success.
Right.
And the big success in his mind, and I believe that this is correct, is touching other people.
Yes, yes.
In an inspiring way, in a way that inspires you to go back to doing what you don't want to do, but you know you have to do.
Yes.
That is, I think he is the id of the sort of quiet majority in this country that the Institute of Race Relations so often talks about. People are so beleaguered and terrorized and depressed and distracted. And yet there is this, so the superficial side of South Africa is terribly broken. But if you get into the living rooms, if you get into the souls of people, you find this true grit, and it's poetic. It's as poetic as this metaphor of birds sort of hunkering on a tree and
hiding being from the rain,
beaten down by the rain, and knowing that there's an eagle above there, and knowing that if they push hard enough, they can pierce the clouds and they can fly higher than the storm. That is such a South African hope. Not that the storm will go away, but that you can fly over it.
Yes.
This guy is the poet of the nation.
He is. That's exactly what he is. We can also glean some more interesting insights into his personality by how he runs his YouTube channel. So one of the things you'll notice if you look at the comment section of his YouTube channel is he makes an effort to like every single one of his viewers' comments, every single one of them. Even if they're hundreds, you will scroll down the list and you will see that he has liked almost every single one of them. Even better than that, if you make a silly meme, which is a remix of him, or you do a video imitating him or copying his style and saying how much you like his videos, if you make any kind of fan content and you send it to him, he uploads it to his channel. And so it's filled with channels saying "with much love from America," "with much love from Mongolia" was a recent one, just of people. And this is another thing where it's also kind of interestingly anti-woke. People imitating his voice and accent, which of course in South Africa is generally a big no-no, in the sort of polite circles. And yet people do it, and he clearly thinks it's funny, and they think it's funny, and there's no like of this heavy baggage between people. It's just people all clutching onto these great videos and having a good time, and it's so wonderful. It's so wonderful.
And I think it really is Joseph Brodsky. Joseph Brodsky was in the gulag for like almost a decade, and he was put to hard labor and people are being killed, but those who survive, he would make himself keep going by this sort of fantastical idea that they were all on holiday together. And he would say, "Oh, the resort is giving us dinner. What's on the menu tonight?" And then they say, "Oh, same thing as last night." And they say, "Fantastic. Last night was my favorite. What is it? Gruel. It is pure, simple gruel." And
good, honest gruel.
And this is how he survived. And this is how he helped other people to survive and to find meaning. And, you know, I think a lot of people know this movie, La Dolce Vita. No. What is it called? The one set in the Nazi camps with the Italian guy. He keeps saying "Principessa." The English translation is "Life is beautiful." Okay. And the story is about a family of Jews, Italian Jews who get detained and put into Nazi camps, and the father and daughter end up being in the camp together. and he makes believe that they are in some kind of theatrical adventure to help the daughter survive. And spoiler alert, he gets shot by the Nazis eventually. But the daughter does survive. And what that father did to shield her from the trauma and at the same time give her the will to live on. You know, I think it'd be very, the sort of movie gives you to understand that that Jews were trying to, were getting married, you know?
Yeah, even in
one of the most stark scenes in Auschwitz before getting shifted to the gas chambers, like people are getting married. What a, I don't know. I think it's hard to even contemplate, but it is an inspiration. And it's a bloody bit of perspective for us because we are facing maladministration, increased joblessness, crime rates.
Or to quote Demi, tough times.
Yeah, tough times. We're facing tough times and people are dying. But for those of us who are lucky enough to survive and not enjoy not just the sunsets and the nature, but to enjoy one another, to enjoy one another as South Africans, to enjoy the creativity and the originality and the foibles and the grammatical errors and the fantastic accents and the colorfulness of this place. To not enjoy that, I think, is actually is missing out on this basic old idea that you've got one life. These are the cards you've been dealt. And what really matters is how you play them.
Right.
And it's profoundly important to play them with grace and to play them with humor and with a bit of warmth.
Yeah, definitely. I actually have a friend who he's an atheist, but he believes essentially that humor is almost of a divine quality. And I think he's right. It is something magical that does give strength and energy to make life worth living in a very real way. And it can be found even in the darkest of places, as you point out.
And Demi, I think it's a great test to take some Demi videos and to play them to yourself and see where you stand and play them to your friends or whoever and see where they stand. If you can't laugh at that because you're too worried about, you know, his grammatical errors or his accent or, you know, I think you're missing his humanity and you're missing his joie de vivre. And at the same time, if you don't find yourself emotionally a bit pulled and inspired, then I think you're on the other end of just laughing and not seeing the full depths of this guy's expression. Yeah,
the wonderfulness of it all.
Yeah, so there's tragedy and there's comedy there too. And I think that's a real bit of magic. And I feel like that thing that Ryan Milan was looking for and that he found in Trevor Noah in the early Zuma days of you know, like a young dude from a sort of weird, funny working class background who was making jokes about the powers that be and getting audiences in Soweto and Santon to all laugh at it. I think that really was a very important thing to find and a very important reason to believe that South Africa could endure, and it did endure. And of course, fame and success can be its own poison. And Demi knows that better than anyone. One of my favorite perverse lines of his, he says, the people that will hurt you the most are the ones closest to you.
Indeed.
Let's hope that the people close to him don't hurt him and that he keeps growing and helping.
Not to ruin the poetry of everything you've just been saying, but he does also do videos from his bubble bath sometimes, which are also, I don't know, they have a very weird quality to them, but I love them.
dude, if he's not having a laugh, if you don't think he's laughing at himself and doing that little thing in the bubble bath.
And actually,
ludic. The old Greek word is ludic.
Yes. So we are actually in a very good space now because we are exactly basically on the hour mark, I think, very close to at least. Now, I don't know really how to end this because, you know, in a sense, we've just spent the whole episode giving recommendations. But do you have a recommendation for our listeners?
Yes, 100%. Next time you feel low and you feel like going slow and you feel like giving up, honest to goodness, go to YouTube, look up Demi Demi, find one that's 45 seconds long, find one of the compilations that's 2.5 minutes long, whatever it is. Just find it, have a look. And it might not always work, but there's a real chance that he will brighten your day and give you something to think about. And I recommend that.
I could say some boring thing, but actually, honestly, there's nothing that's going to, for me, compared to that. I really love his videos. My friends love his videos. They're a good time. I think they cross so many, like, they're so accessible to so many different groups of people. Whether you live in South Africa, whether you're successful, whether you're not, whether you're old, whether you're young, he's just beautiful. Anyway, so we delicious. Recommend Demi Demi. I'll put probably in the description, in the sort of description of this episode, I'll put a link to his YouTube channel. You can go and have a look at that, or just search it on YouTube. It's pretty easy to find. And with that, I think we should call the episode to a close, unless you have anything desperately you need to say at the end.
No. Good. Other than the old Soviet line that I said right on our first podcast of the year, happiness is not forbidden. It cannot be forbidden.
Yes. Okay, sorry, can I tell you a Soviet joke? I've got another one. I don't know if we can tell this one. There's that's not actually a Soviet joke, but it's a communist joke. It's the Poles are standing in a line in communist Poland, and they're standing in a line for meat. And it's taking forever, and it's taking forever. And eventually, there's a man. He's been sitting in the line for hours and hours, and he gets close to the front. And then they say, "Sorry, comrades, there's no more meat available today. Go home." And he stands up and he says, "This is too much. We've been standing in this line for hours, and now there isn't even meat. What can we say? What was the revolution about? If you know, we're all going to be without even meat today. You know, back in the day, there was meat, even though times were bad." I can't stand the system anymore. This things needs to change. And a man in a trench coat steps out of the shadows, and everyone sort of shies away from him, and he approaches the man who was expressing his grievances, and he goes up to me and he says, Comrade, you know you shouldn't be saying things like that. In the old days, if you said something like that," and then he mimes, he puts like his finger to his head looking like a gun, and he makes like he's pulling the trigger. Says, "You would have ended up in the ground if you said things like that, comrade." Anyway, the old man goes home then. And his wife says, "Are things bad? Did you get any meat?" And he said, "Oh, they're worse than I thought. They've run out of bullets." I would like to urge you all to keep the flag of liberty flying. Have a wonderful weekend, everyone.